Now, shall we begin?
We are close to the brother and the family. We have heard various things about the incident, and we do not believe that the sheriff's office is telling the truth and that there was a great injustice done to Mr. Yankees. And we also feel like it could have been any of us. Your heart just bleeds for the family. And also for the families of the officers who did this. We don't want it to be just washed away, go for months and months and hope that people forget about it. We want something, some resolution to come of this and to have justice for the Yantas family.
The Idaho State Police is investigating this, and they are notoriously unreliable at investigating officer-involved deaths that involve sheriff's deputies. And the FBI has started another investigation into what's going on here. My assumption is that you have two separate investigations going on for the purpose of diffusing accountability rather than for the purpose of achieving transparency and some kind of factually supportable outcome. What I anticipate is that these investigations will end with a grudging and sorrowful but necessary justified ruling, which is to say the actions of the deputies will be considered reasonable under the Graham versus Connor Supreme Court decision of 1985. Where we're supposed to look at what happened from the perspective of the proverbial reasonable officer on the scene. And if there's a sense that they are in any way imperiled by the actions of a suspect or a subject, then lethal force is justified, even though it wouldn't be for a common citizen, or as I call us, mere mundanes.
The foregoing clip contained comments I offered on November 21st of last year, just a couple of weeks after the murder, no other word is suitable, of Council Idaho rancher Jack Yantas by deputies Cody Rowland and Brian Wood of the Adams County Sheriff's Office. Mr. Yantas had been summoned by the Sheriff's Office to dispose of a bull who had been hit on Interstate 95. The bull belonged to Mr. Yantas. He did not have any liability for the accident under Idaho's open range law, which I think is questionable, but yet it is the statutory authority governing collisions between automobiles and livestock in that part of Idaho. According to Deputy Wood's account, they called Yantas to the scene because they were, quote, afraid of liability in the destruction of the bull or having failed to dispose of this animal competently in the event that the bull had charged and injured somebody on the scene. They couldn't handle this problem, so they summoned him to the scene. In the investigation that was released by Attorney General Larry Wasden yesterday, that would have been the 29th of July, great emphasis is placed on the emotional state of Mr. Yantas, that he was upset that he had been drinking beer, and so they crafted a narrative in which he was to some extent responsible for what happened, omitting mention of the fact that it was the incompetence of these deputies that resulted in their de facto decision to deputize the rancher. He arrived on the scene. He told Deputy Wood, who had been ineptly trying to kill the animal with a small caliber rifle, to get that piece of shit away from my animal, the piece of shit in question being the rifle, that this highly trained sniper could not use competently to dispose of the bull. The entire encounter lasted about 5 minutes. Competent witnesses on the scene, Donna Yantas, the now widow of Jack Yantas, she was 63 at the time, he was 62, and family friend Rowdy Paradis, who drove up to the scene on a skid loader in order to dispose of the carcass of the animal, say that at some point, either Wood or Rowland, most likely Rowland, grabbed Jack as he was prepared to fire a shot. If his gun was discharged at the scene, and that's a matter of some dispute, there was an empty casing found in the rifle. There was a bullet found on the ground that was tentatively identified as a .20 caliber round from that bolt-action rifle, although the FBI lab report suggests that it's impossible, accurately and definitively, to verify that this was a 20 caliber round. It might have been one of the rounds fired by either Wood, who was armed once again with a small caliber rifle, or by Roland, who was using a Glock. If there was a discharge of Yantis's rifle, it was precipitated by the actions of one of the deputies, once again most likely Roland, who, according to the non-killers on the scene, according to the witnesses on the scene, grabbed Yantis and jerked him violently by the vest, causing his rifle to turn in a broad arc, roughly in the direction of Roland, who opened fire, and in an act of what is called contagious or sympathetic gunfire, Wood joined in. The two of them pumped 12 rounds into this innocent man, leaving him mortally stricken on the scene. Then they arrested his widow, spread-eagling her on the pavement, inducing a heart attack that nearly killed her. And they arrested the other witness on the scene. They called for backup. When backup arrived, the first priority in such cases, of course, is always to make sure that the killers are fine. As Mrs. Yantis was being taken off in the ambulance to the hospital, she recorded the first eyewitness account of this killing. Jack went down to shoot the bull. They called, Mrs. Yantis weakly said, as she was tethered to an IV in the back of the ambulance. A cop came up and grabbed his arm and jerked him backwards, and then they shot him 4 or 6 times. They just shot him for no reason. Roland and Wood have given contradictory accounts of what happened. In an investigative interview carried out about a month after the shooting, Roland claimed that there was no physical contact prior to the shooting. Specifically, he did not see Wood grab Yantis, but rather that Yantis pushed Wood. Yantis was a small, wiry 62-year-old man. Brian Wood was 31 at the time of the killing. He was larger, he was muscular, he boasted of being trained by the Navy SEALs. He had certainly undergone sniper training put on by the FBI in Chicago several years earlier. Roland had claimed that Yantis shoved Wood, which left this younger, more muscular deputy with his leg up as he reached down to grab the rifle, according to one of the earliest accounts given by Roland. As a matter of fact, it was a handwritten account composed immediately after the shooting. That detail appeared to have prompted skepticism on the part of one of the interviewers. The handwritten notes of an unidentified Idaho State Police interviewer contain the following comments. "I have a very hard time believing an older man whose hips are being held together by a steel girdle could shove a very strong cop moving in with purpose to control the situation." That same investigator took note of the fact that there was a contradiction about Wood being involved in a struggle. How was there a struggle if Wood was off balance? "In addition," he wrote, "you both talk about expecting him," meaning Yantis, "to stop, but both talk about firing as fast as possible." In the same batch of notes, we read the following suggestion. "Should we talk about sympathetic shooting?" Which would mean, in simple terms, that without knowing what's going on, one of the deputies fired and the other one joined in because that's what they're trained to do. They are trained to kill when there is any colorable pretext to do so, acting in the serene confidence that they, as the reasonable officers on the scene, will never have their judgment seriously questioned. According to the Graham v. Connor ruling, which was actually handed down in 1989, dealing with the 1985 case, I incorrectly stated that it was a 1985 ruling. The incident happened in 1985. The Supreme Court ruling was handed down 4 years later. In the Graham versus Connor ruling, it is the subjective perception of the officer who uses lethal force that is taken as definitive. He is the reasonable officer on the scene. His judgment cannot be questioned by witnesses who are mere mundanes. The use of force by a police officer is considered to be self-ratifying. When a police officer uses lethal force, the assumption is that it is justified, and that presumption cannot be overcome by the testimony, however compelling or plausible, of somebody who is not part of the anointed brotherhood of state-sanctioned coercion. This is why, in November of last year, 8 months before Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin would bring to an eminently predictable end this cynical exercise in Kabuki theater that they called an investigation into the murder of Jack Yantis, why I was able to predict that this act would be considered legally justifiable. It is all but impossible to hold a police officer legally responsible as an individual for an act of homicide, because blue privilege dictates that his judgment cannot be questioned by witnesses who are mere mundanes. I will have, of course, a lot more to say about this when I return. This is Will Grigg with Freedom Zealot Radio. Please stand by for more Sedition after this. Particularly relevant law, wrote Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin of the state of Idaho in his July 29th letter announcing that no criminal charges would be filed against the two deputies who murdered Jack Yantas. The particularly relevant law provides that a homicide committed by a public officer is justified when reasonably necessary in overcoming actual resistance to the execution of some legal process or in the discharge of any other legal duty, including keeping and preserving the peace. If deadly force is used to overcome actual resistance, the officer must have probable cause to believe that the resistance poses a threat of death or serious physical injury to the officer or other persons. I should point out at this juncture that every police officer is just certain that he is constantly threatened with death or physical injury. Constructively, this means that any police officer who uses deadly force can utter the magical incantation, "I was in fear for my life," or "for the safety of others," and everything he does is considered to be legally justifiable. Most important to the charging decision in this case, continued Wasdin, the jury instruction for this defense requires that the burden is on the prosecution to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the homicide was not justifiable, and if there was a reasonable doubt whether the homicide was justifiable, the jury must find the defendant not guilty. That is not the same standard used when a mere citizen is accused of criminal homicide. In cases of that kind, the defendant must create, in the minds of the jury, legal justification for his actions. His story is not considered to be self-ratifying, whereas that of a police officer is. Finally, continues Wasdin, in reference to officer-involved shooting cases, the United States Supreme Court has explained that the calculus of reasonableness must embody allowance for the fact that police officers are often forced to make split-second judgments in circumstances that are tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving. By the way, the same is true of any self-defense scenario involving an actual citizen in the productive sector. They don't do this by way of occupation. They're not invested, normal citizens, with the presumptive authority to use coercive force up to and including lethal force. But when they use lethal force, that is to say, private citizens who are threatened with actual criminal violence, they too are making split-second judgments in circumstances that are tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving, but they have a different legal standard that is more exacting. With the official privilege of killing comes the presumption of self-extenuation. If police officers are justified in firing at a suspect in order to end a severe threat to public safety, the officers need not stop shooting until the threat has ended, whether or not that threat actually exists. That actually is a citation to a 2014 case entitled Plumhoff v. Rickard. Since the justifiable homicide by officer statute is ultimately dispositive, Wasdin concluded, the OAG's analysis does not address whether the killing of Jack Yantas was with malice aforethought, meaning murder, upon a sudden quarrel or heat of passion voluntary manslaughter, or the result of reckless, careless, or negligent operation of a firearm, involuntary manslaughter. None of those forms of criminal homicide is implicated by this set of circumstances because of the identity of the killers, because they were part of the costumed overseer class. None of these considerations apply because their actions are presumed to be reasonable because they carried them out. The lack of any truly persuasive physical evidence dictates that a jury would have to rely primarily on the differing accounts of the four primary witnesses. There are actually two primary witnesses. There are two suspects, or at least there should be two suspects. In every officer-involved shooting, it is the dead citizen who is identified as the suspect. Whether or not the citizen was armed, or whether the citizen was a suspect in an actual crime, as Jack Yantis was not. Because he caught rounds that were fired at him by members of the privileged Blue Tribe, Yantis was considered a suspect, and the shooters were designated the victims. Every police shooting is investigated in this fashion. Every police shooting is an exercise in validating that police shooting. Because if the officer or officers were to be regarded as a suspect, you would be building a case against him or them, rather than building a case against the person who was shot. On the one hand, Wasden writes, Rowdy and Donna, that is to say Rowdy Paradis and Donna Yantis, the victim's widow, claimed the officers fired upon Jack without provocation or justification. On the other hand, Wood and Roland claim they fired upon Jack in response to what they believed was the threat of death or serious bodily injury. The ultimate question is whether, when weighing these contradictory accounts, a jury would have reasonable doubt as to whether the officer's use of deadly force was not reasonably necessary. There's never any reasonable doubt under the formulation prescribed by Graham v. Connor et sequentia. There's never any reasonable doubt because the officer is presumed to be reasonable. You cannot doubt the word of the officer. This is another inversion of the standard rules of evidence that apply in a case of suspected criminal homicide. While it could be argued that the officers fired in a fit of recklessness, or that Wood escalated the situation because he was upset with Jack's slight of his prized weapon, the officers' explanations that Jack pointed his gun at Roland create reasonable doubt, undermining those arguments, because it is their story. If we were dealing with Cody Roland and Brian Wood, private citizens in the productive class, rather than Deputy Cody Roland and Deputy Brian Wood, part of the elite, incomparably valuable cadre of state-licensed enforcers, their story would not be taken as definitive. While the officers' stories are not identical with each other in every detail, there is sufficient consistency between them to create, at a minimum, reasonable doubt regarding whether their actions were not justified. Notice how these self-nullifying negatives accumulate here. This is language that was written to obfuscate, not to clarify. It's important to point out that not only are their stories not identical with each other's, but there are internal inconsistencies in each story told by each of these two men who should be regarded as suspects. As a matter of fact, Cody Roland did not clarify certain points in his story until June 3rd of this year, 7 months following the events that transpired. It wasn't until an interview with two Idaho State troopers and an FBI agent that Roland stated definitively that Wood had never laid hands on Yantis, but rather that Yantis had somehow shoved Wood away. And that is a matter that had been addressed in November or December of last year by one of the initial ISP investigators. We're supposed to believe that this nearly crippled 62-year-old man was able to shove away a larger, more muscular 31-year-old deputy. Their stories were not subject to critical scrutiny because of who they were. It is entirely possible that if this case had gone to trial, as it should have, that a police union attorney would have been able to create sufficient reasonable doubt in the mind of the jury as to the stories that are told by Roland and Wood. It's entirely possible that he would have been able to impeach the testimony of the two witnesses on the scene. There was a third witness who was never interviewed by the ISP, and only a perfunctory effort was made to contact him. It's entirely possible that after a criminal trial, Cody Rowland and Brian Wood would have been acquitted because of reasonable doubt, which of course would be a sound and appropriate and healthy outcome. But the point is, because of who they were, they never faced the legitimate possibility of being held legally accountable, as would everybody else in Adams County who was not part of the state's enforcement cast under identical circumstances. I'll be back in just a few minutes.
Samurai.
Yes, it is. And quite a proud one from the looks of him. Oh dear, this is bad. He's expecting them to show deference.
I am one who always says that you should comply with police officers, especially as a man of color.
That's
exactly when I'm stopped
correct.
By police officers.
I tell my kids the same
officer,
thing.
Officer, why are you stopping me? Yes. Yes, officer, or whatever. Now, I'm an American. I shouldn't have to do that. I shouldn't have to be yes-siring anybody, right? I'm a grown, you-know-what man.
You don't have to say sir, but if he's giving you the law,
but okay. I do it because I want to stay alive.
An LAPD officer who writes for National Review magazine under the nom de cyber Jack Dunphy has candidly explained that in any encounter between a police officer and a citizen, or if you will, a mere mundane, only one life really matters, and it is not the latter. The mundane, according to Dunphy, must bear in mind that the officer is not all that concerned with trying not to offend you. He is instead concerned with protecting his mortal hide from having holes placed in it where God did not intend, and you, if in asserting your constitutional right to be free from unlawful search and seizure, fail to do as the officer asks, run the risk of having such holes placed in your own. What Officer Dunphy is articulating here is a contemporary American version of what was called, and please forgive me for inevitably butchering this Japanese expression, Kirisut Gomen in feudal Japan. That phrase, roughly translated as authorization to cut and leave, referred to the power exercised by samurai, the shogun's armed enforcement caste, to kill anyone from a lower caste who merely insulted them. A few years ago, I called Dr. John Pierre Mertz, who is a professor of Japanese language at the University of North Carolina, and asked him to explain the background of this concept of Kirisut Gomen. Before the Meiji Restoration of 1868, there was a legal structure in place whereby people of the samurai class or higher could kill anyone of the agrarian class or lower who insulted them. The samurai literally had the power to cut people in two if they considered the insult to be intolerable. This was part of the culture, and people were very aware of it. In fact, there were manuals that described how a woman could clean and prepare a decapitated head for burial. They took contempt of cop very seriously in pre-Meiji Japan, in other words. There's no reliable way of knowing how often this form of summary execution, which was sometimes referred to as, once again I will butcher the Japanese, bure uchi, or striking down the impolite. We have no way of knowing how often this was carried out, and what accounts do exist tend to be encrusted with accumulated myth and legend. Understandably, Dr. Mertz continued, very few people were willing to stick around and witness incidents of this kind. It's important to understand as well that the consequences of an act of this kind could be quite severe. Since a killing of this kind was taken as evidence of failure on everybody's part to uphold the societal code, this is where things get a little bit interesting. There would be an inquest, and if a samurai were found to have killed an inferior for no good reason, he would be compelled to apologize, which meant committing ritual suicide through seppuku. So it's likely that things of this kind happened rarely in feudal Japan. Things of this kind happen every damn day in the United States of America. On average, there is one or two police killings every day in the United States. Not every one of them could be considered justifiable under the standards that apply to the common citizenry. Another historical analysis of the Edo period maintains that there was another very important restraint on the power of samurai to execute impudent commoners. By that account, a commoner had the absolute innate right to use lethal force in self-defense against what we would now refer to as police brutality. A commoner who killed a samurai in self-defense was not subject to punishment of any kind, since that act would have culled an unsuitable specimen from the warrior caste. A peasant targeted for execution but who escaped with his life would not be tracked down and charged with resisting arrest or evasion of the police. Instead, once again, based on this historical account from the Edo period, the samurai who needlessly drew his sword was subject to severe punishment for disrupting the peace. Dr. Mertz insists that in the Japanese feudal system, only fellow samurai or their superiors could seek retribution for criminal violence against those in lower orders. He told me, and I quote, if an agrarian person were to lift a finger against the disciplining power, it would be a really serious thing. What this means is that a Japanese commoner could not pursue a vendetta to punish a samurai who had abused a commoner. But at the moment of violence, if the commoner fought back, he was within his rights. If the samurai survived, he would face administrative punishment, which might include ritual suicide. And if the samurai is killed, then that's on him. Once again, it's difficult to say exactly how the laws were implemented, since there isn't a lot of detailed reporting on the subject. The dreadful penalties inflicted on samurai who needlessly killed commoners provide a very compelling deterrent against the use of unjustified violence by the enforcement caste. How frequently would American police, one wonders, resort to unnecessary force if they, in the fashion of Japanese samurai, confronted the prospect of enduring exactly what they illicitly inflict on others? The post-1868 Japanese elite, Dr. Mertz explained to me, was forced to abolish Kiritsui Gomen because the idea of empowering police to execute citizens for impudence was offensive to the then-extant Anglo-Saxon view of individual liberty protected by law. That, of course, is the same tradition that supposedly begat the American Constitution. After Japan was opened to the West, citizens from Western nations who lived in colonial enclaves were protected by extraterritoriality agreements secured through British treaties, Dr. Mertz pointed out to me. Western governments weren't going to permit their citizens to be struck down in the streets because they refused to genuflect to samurai. So the Japanese revoked the enforcement caste's license to kill. We do not see a reciprocal respect on the part of the American Imperium for Japanese residing in Okinawa, which is occupied by a very large military base whose occupants frequently inflict lethal harm on the citizenry and yet are protected, the American military personnel and contractors. They are protected through extraterritoriality, which does not recognize the rights of the natives. I submit that it is a sobering and inescapable fact that in Lee Greenwood's America, where at least we know we're free, supposedly, the police consistently enjoy a far greater scope and latitude regarding official impunity than that which was granted to the roaming warriors of feudal Japan. I'll be back in just a minute.
Says, dear Lord, life is precious. Therefore, people deserve necessary treatment that sustains their life. Life is a good and God-given gift. Life is the most fundamental and irreplaceable condition of the human experience. And it must be treated with complete respect and dignity. God is the first one who said, choose life. So it is wise to choose those directives that would be life beneficial to a person. My brother never got that chance. Please, at this time, would you thank everyone here for us as we know that their prayers and Jack's life is in their heart, and we thank them for that. In Jesus' name, we say these things.
My lords and ladies, I would like to present to you Sir Robin of Locksley. Bring Sir Robin food at once, do you hear? Such impudence must support a mighty appetite.
True enough, Your Highness. We Saxons have little to fatten on by the time your tax gatherers are through. Be seated, gentlemen. No need to stand on ceremony on my account.
So you think you're overtaxed, eh?
Overtaxed, overworked, and paid off with a knife, a club, or a rope.
Why, you speak treason.
Fluently.
In 1852, a resident of California by the name of George Hall was convicted of murdering a man of Chinese ancestry. His defense attorney appealed the conviction on the basis of a California statute barring testimony by African Americans, at the time, of course, called Negroes, mulattoes, which is to say people of mixed African Caucasian ancestry, and Indians. This law, he said, applied to all non-whites, among whom we would number Chinese. In 1862, in the case of Ling Sing versus Washburn, the state Supreme Court of California concurred. The appellant, a free white citizen of this state, was convicted of murder upon the testimony of Chinese witnesses. Note, plural, Chinese witnesses. The point involved in this case is the admissibility of such evidence. Not the quality or soundness of that evidence, mind you, but the admissibility. The 394th section of the Act concerning civil cases provides that no Indian or Negro shall be allowed to testify as a witness in any action or proceeding in which a white person is a party. The 14th section of the Act of April 16, 1850, regulating criminal proceedings, provides that no black or mulatto person or Indian shall be allowed to give evidence in favor of or against a white man. The true point at which we are anxious to arrive is the legal signification of the words black, mulatto, Indian, and white person, and whether the legislature adopted them as generic terms or intended to limit their application to specific types of the human species. The Act of Congress, in defining that description of aliens who may become naturalized citizens, provides that every free white citizen, etc., If the term white, as used in the Constitution, was not understood in its generic sense as including the Caucasian race, and necessarily excluding all others, where was the necessity of providing for the admission of Indians to the privilege of voting by special legislation? We are of the opinion that the words white, Negro, mulatto, Indian, and black person, wherever they occur in our Constitution and laws, must be taken in their generic sense, and that even admitting the Indian of this continent is not of the Mongolian type, that the words black person in the 14th section must be taken as contradistinguished from white, and necessarily excludes all races other than Caucasian. We have carefully considered all the consequences resulting from a different rule of construction, and are satisfied that even in a doubtful case, we would be impelled to this decision on ground of public policy. The same rule which would admit them to testify would admit them to all the equal rights of citizenship, and we might soon see them at the polls, in the jury box, upon the bench, and in our legislative halls. Oh, what fell horror that would entail! I continue. This is not a speculation which exists in the excited and overheated imagination of the patriot and statesman, but it is an actual and present danger, continued the Supreme Court of the State of California. The anomalous spectacle of a distinct people living in our community, recognizing no laws of this state, except through necessity, bringing with them their prejudices and national feuds, in which they indulge in open violation of law, whose mendacity is proverbial, a race of people whom nature has marked as inferior, and who are incapable of progress or intellectual development beyond a certain point, as their history has shown, differing in language, opinions, color, and physical conformation, between whom and ourselves nature has placed an impassable difference, is now presented, and for them is claimed not only the right to swear away the life of a citizen, but the further privilege of participating with us in administering the affairs of our government. These facts were before the legislature that framed this act, and have been known as matters of public history to every subsequent legislature. There can be no doubt as to the intention of the legislature, and that if it had ever been anticipated that this class of people were not embraced in the prohibition, the class of people to whom they refer would be Chinese, then such specific words would have been employed as would have put the matter beyond any possible controversy. For these reasons, we are of the opinion that the testimony was inadmissible, the judgment is reversed, and the case remanded. Something broadly similar obtains with respect to an accusation by multiple citizens against a police officer of whatever national background the citizens might be, of whatever national background the officer might be. The positivist enactments called laws and the judicial rulings that are made pursuant to those enactments have placed an impassable difference between the public at large and the members of the privileged blue tribe who are invested with the discretionary supposed right to use lethal force, and collaterally invested with the presumption that their use of force is justifiable because they use it. There are no legal prohibitions that ban citizen testimony against police officers in a criminal proceeding. There is, however, an institutional apparatus that selects against any outcome that would place police officers in the position of being defendants in such criminal proceedings. It surprises me not at all that Idaho Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin, who once tried to imprison a 66-year-old retired nun for the supposed crime of acting as a conscientious juror in a minor narcotics possession case, has never distinguished himself by his zeal for officer accountability. Nor did it surprise me at all that he ruled that the justifiable homicide by officer statute is ultimately dispositive in the case of Jack Yantis. The Yantis family has filed a notice of tort claim against the county. They've requested $500,000 in civil damages, which I believe is the maximum amount allowed by statute. It's almost impossible to believe that that lawsuit will prevail. In any case, the two deputies never missed a paycheck. They were placed on paid vacation, and according to Sheriff Ryan Zolman, they are prepared to return to their duties. And in making that announcement, Sheriff Zolman decanted this astounding specimen of statist sanctimony. It is a bit of a comfort for the office and for the department to know that based on the evidence and based on the facts, that the officers did their job and weren't excessive in doing so. In a separate interview with KIVI, which is the ABC affiliate in Boise, Zolman actually appealed to the family of the victim and citizens of Adams County who were outraged by this spectacle of murderous impunity to accept the system's vindication of the killers of Jack Yantas as a manifestation of the divine will. Quote, "I hope and pray that cool heads will prevail. I am a man of faith, and I believe nothing happens without a reason. Leave this to a higher power watching over us." Apparently it was just God's will that Jack Yantas be cut down in a hail of gunfire because he had been trying to help a couple of manifestly incompetent deputies to deal with an emergency that they couldn't handle. One of whom, Brian Wood, on January 22nd of this year, was the subject of an officer safety flyer because he was considered to be deranged and a threat to the Blue Tribe. And now he's going to be unleashed once again as part of the enforcement cast in Adams County, Idaho. Sheriff Zolman was not content to rely upon the superintending care of Providence on January 22nd after Deputy Wood, during an incident of domestic violence involving his now estranged wife, threatened the lives of other members of the state's punitive priesthood. Quote, "If cops are involved, shots will be fired," Wood told a friend by the name of William Gallagher. In the bulletin that was disseminated for the benefit of law enforcement, not the public, if I'm not mistaken, this was a time prior to Wood's identification as one of the shooters. He was on paid vacation. Nobody knew his whereabouts. Law enforcement was provided with notification that Wood was potentially dangerous to them. He was described as a highly trained sniper, believed to have demolition capabilities and access to explosives, and suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. He was considered an impermissible threat to the incomparably precious lives of his fellow state enforcers on the basis of what he said. The fact that he and Roland murdered an innocent man doesn't disqualify him from being entrusted with the supposed authority to be a costumed overseer of the residents of Adams County. Because in the final analysis, the lives of mundanes don't matter. Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I'll be back with you again in a week. And until then, as always, dum spirito pugno, while I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and may we send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
You still try to fight? Can't you see that it's hopeless?
That man won't quit as long as he can still draw a breath. None of my teammates will.
What do you want to do now, Captain?
The same thing we always do. Fight him until we can't.